So I'm Dan Gibbons. I'm the CEO of City Club of Chicago, and on behalf of the City Club and our Board of Governors, welcome to City Club. This is not our usual location, but how neat is it that we are here? And what an amazing building. It was fun to just watch approaching it, the original Sears Tower. As Lori Glenn said, we're taking City Club to whole new levels. We're literally on the top level. So as we finish up today, make sure you go and check out those views because it's pretty amazing. And this is such a great part of the city. And of course, we get a nice view, Eric, of the BMO Tower out there. You know, you just got to make sure you notice that. Thank you for being here. As I said, this is not our usual City Club location, and that's intentional. We are so intent on tackling all sorts of interesting topics and doing it from every corner of the city. And this is an early start to that effort to get out into the neighborhoods and understand and elevate all the great things that are happening, because there's so much good that's happening in this city of Chicago. And so many people that are doing all that good are here in this room. So thank you for being here. I just want to do a quick round of thank yous before we kick this off. Of course, the Joyce Foundation. So the Joyce Foundation is our partner in this. Thank you, Tim, and you'll hear from Tim and me, Tim. And this is the first of what will be a three-part series. It's certainly not the first thing we've done with the Joyce Foundation, but the first in a three-part series. So we hope you'll return for all of those, and they will likely be in other locations. That'll be more to come. So keep an eye out for that. We're going to call this Ending Gun Violence in Chicago. Talk about big, bold ideas. Not lessening. Ending Gun Violence in Chicago. Connecting policy, practice, and community. So that is what we're doing here in partnership with the Joyce Foundation, also with Black Roots Alliance, with WTTW's First Hand Initiative, and of course, and thank you Black Roots Alliance, and of course WTTW News. There are some folks, including Brandis, in the room from WTTW. Thank you all for all of your partnership and your efforts to get us here today so we can perhaps create a safer Chicago for everybody. It really wouldn't have been possible without Lori Glenn. I mentioned Lori also. Thank you, Lori, for all the great ideas and the great programming that you bring to City Club. And of course, I believe we have Natasha Scott is here, the Assistant Deputy Mayor for Community Safety. I'd like to say thank you to her for all of her efforts and for being here with us today. And, of course, the Foundation for Home and Square, who maintains this incredible historic space. Be Love Cafe, where's Be Love at? We all are trying some food, and thank you. We love Be Love. And they're located just down the street in the North Lawndale Employment Network, which is another great partner of City Club. So this is just collaboration at its best, right? Okay, I am going to introduce someone. I think I've got Amanda. Have I done everything I need to do? Okay, so what I'd like to do is to share more about how this is going to work. I'd please welcome Caitlin Johnson, who is the Executive Director of Black Roots Alliance, one of our partners. Yes. Thank you, Caitlin.
Good evening, everyone. Again, my name is Caitlin. I'm Executive Director of Black Roots Alliance, and our organization is committed to the safety and liberation of all Black people. And we do it in community because we believe that not only are we stronger together, but there is no system outside of ourselves. The system is created by the sum of our values multiplied by our decisions and has an exponential impact on everyone that we touch. And that includes all of you in this room today. Thank you all so much for coming. So before we get started with the panel, we're going to watch a video. And this video is an opportunity for some Black business owners who I saw in the crowd today. I don't know where you're all at now, but please see them after because they're sharing their direct lived experience of being in relationship with communities that are pressed by crime and violence. And so as you're listening to the panel, as you're watching the video, ask yourself what parts resonate with you. If somebody makes a point that is meaningful to you, take note of it. And also, if someone makes a point that you disagree with or makes you feel uncomfortable, take note of that too. And ask yourself why you feel that way. Because after the panel, we're going to have an opportunity to talk to one another and engage in community conversations. For folks who know their facilitators, can you raise your hand at your table? I see a couple people raising their hands. If you happen to not have a facilitator at your table, there is a manila envelope, and someone can volunteer to be a facilitator. And in that envelope, there are some questions that we're going to start the conversations with at our table. We're going to take good notes and report back the highlights from our conversations, and everything will be included in the white paper after the end of the series of events. If for some reason you don't have time to get your point across, there are also note cards in every envelope where you can write it down so we can make sure that we include as many voices as possible, because it's going to take all of us to end gun violence in Chicago. And with that, we can cue the video.
There was just a shooting yesterday.
You know, if you see something, say something, that applies to just about anything you do.
Having events that are for the community.
We provide a network to each other to help keep all of us sane.
I'm a black-owned business. We're boots on the ground 24 hours a day when there's a shooting, saving lives, CPR, going to victim houses and helping out with funerals, things like that.
Community has to work with the government, your aldermen, your state reps, your state senators, the mayor, because they have access to money that some organizations don't have access to.
They know what which communities need the most help. They see the stats. They get the reports.
Taking a moment to address some of the basic things, you know, people not feeling supported, people not feeling heard, seen, all of those things, not feeling like they have a sense of community.
The city offers all of these resources, the aldermen, the mayor. There's all sorts of programs. We can put on programs and bring NASCAR here. We can set the city up. We can do whatever we want to do to put on Lollapalooza. We can do whatever we want to do to put on the Taste of Chicago. Well, those same resources could be poured into each and every community. We know which communities are bad. We know which communities are underfunded.
Things that I think people can do to take care of their mental wellness. You may be expecting something extremely profound. However, I think it comes down to the basic things that humans need, right? Really just sleep, nutrition, and movement.
Education, resources, and time. Those three things, because if you got time to educate somebody, you have time to watch that person that you're trying to educate, develop, and then if you pour resources into that particular program that you're putting together, it'll continue to feed itself. So with those three elements, there's nothing that can't be done.
Really, it's just a sense of lack of hope for better, that tends to be the thing. You know, when people don't feel like they have any other options, or, you know, when they think things are just, it's just going to be this way, they tend to not, be as invested in the choices that they make and how it impacts other people.
Resources are huge, and being able to have the right resources, especially in black and brown communities, are essential, because there's a lack thereof.
So it's like the things that I can do, with my expertise, I can help a lot. I can save a lot of lives. I can do a lot with it. But, you know, we don't have the funding. We don't get the funding that the other organizations get. So if more black-owned businesses got the funding, got the stipends, or got the city grants and loans, you know, we could do more training. We could train more parents how to save lives. We could train more business owners how to save lives. We could save more kids how to save a life. I mean, just imagine if you could teach a kid how to save another kid's life. I mean, the average kid these days is getting shot at 18 or under, but they don't have the idea on how to save a life. You know, if more black-owned businesses get the funding like other businesses and just get more help, you know, I think we can do a lot to help the gun violence in Chicago and in the world, period.
Great, and we'll make sure to share that video on City Club's website as it's live streamed, and then we have this always archived. So please guide people to watch that. That's an incredible video. Thank you, Caitlin, for the intro and for setting that up. With no more further ado, she doesn't need an intro. Everyone knows Brandis from WTTW, a great partner in all of this, from Chicago Tonight. She's going to take everything from here, Brandis Friedman. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you all. She's going to introduce our panel. So thank you. Welcome to all our panelists.
Thank you, Dan. Hello, everybody. And thank you for allowing me to join you. Like Dan said, I am Brandis Friedman from WTTW. I am going to start by introducing our panelists. One is still en route, which is kind of funny because she was the one that I was going to ask the first question of. So naturally, I have to reroute. But that's okay. I feel like this room is a little more intimate than what we might be used to. But I think that's a good thing to have sort of an intimate conversation. And of course, there will be an opportunity if you've got questions. There's a way to submit questions on these lovely blue pieces of paper blue pieces of paper that are at your table. And at some point, we will collect them, and I'll do our best to share those with you, because I think you also know that we're going to get together a little bit later on and talk some more. So, with that, I'm going to start with you, Tim, and thank you for allowing me to join you today. Let's start with, remember when the 5-6 of us met, we talked about the Joyce Foundation's report, Reimagining Public Safety. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, well, first and foremost, thank you for joining us today, and thanks to all of our partners, including Black Roots Alliance and WTTW and City Club, for being here. You know, what Brandis is referring to is that, you know, we at the Joyce Foundation, over time, have evolved in how we have thought about public safety. For 30 years, the foundation has had a focus on gun violence prevention, and that has been a key program area that we have invested funding in. But as we've learned more about it, and as we invested about a third of our dollars in that area on research, we better understood how gun violence intersects with other key issues, like policing, like community violence intervention and the sort. And for us, that started to evolve not just how we were grant-making, but how we even call ourselves. Now we're the Gun Violence Prevention and Justice Reform Program. And the reason is that we believe, ultimately, that in order to have safe and just communities, you need to have a reimagined public safety ecosystem, if you will. And those elements by themselves are important, but they're not sufficient. You need all of those elements to work together and be intersectional, whether that be on gun policy, whether that be on fair and just policing, whether that be community violence intervention and otherwise. And so for us, the thrust of what you're referring to is how we now think about all of those elements together and connected.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I read, the four sort of conclusions, recommendations that came of that are strengthen Black community relationships, invest in well-being and opportunity, improve public defender visibility and interaction with the community, and decrease public defender caseloads. And I want to come to each of those a little bit. Lauren, I want to start with you if I can, because one of those recommendations, as I said, is to strengthen Black community relationships. Tell us why that's important and how Black Roots Alliance works to do that.
Well, over a year ago, Black Roots Alliance had the opportunity to partner with Black Public Defender Association, also the Cook County Public Defender Association, and also we work with Northwestern University. And in that project, we had the opportunity to interview and sit down and speak to over 100 Chicagoans from all across the city. And what we've learned during those conversations, where we were looking into public safety in our community, that violence and gun violence, they intersected during those conversations. The community has the answers. That's pretty much what we learned. And we've learned by having these conversations and listening to these collective experiences, we're able to share and also come up with new policies that can affect change in our community.
Rebecca, the report, it also calls for, as I said, investing in well-being and opportunity. What does that look like from your perspective and the kind of work that you do?
Yeah, well, first off, thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this panel. It's really a remarkable group, and I want to applaud the Joyce Foundation in particular for seeing the first response ecosystem as exactly that, an ecosystem. These are interrelated and interdependent parts that unfortunately have been treated almost in a medical way in isolation, which isn't helpful, right? We need to address all of the root causes here, and I appreciate your comment about us being in close space and proximity to do so. We cannot no longer really ignore that these things are happening and what the systemic situations are that have resulted in the realities. But we also have to, I think, take stock of the fact that there are progress markers that we can be proud of. For example, just this morning, the Council on Criminal Justice released their midterm crime report that showed that Chicago's homicide rate for the first 6 months of this calendar year is actually lower than it was in 2019 for the first 6 months of the year. So we are, you know, coming back to pre-pandemic levels, and we need to not only look at the detrimental aspects and the ways in which this is harming communities, but also try to take stock of progress and be able to continue to encourage all of the really wonderful things that are happening and to continue to invest in the much more that's needed.
And I have to say this now, so you also do some work with, you know, sort of reimagining how we use 911 and transform 911, and it is not lost on me that we are having this conversation, you know, several days after seeing that horrific video of Sonya Massey being killed in Springfield. Tell me a little bit about your work to transform 911 and how that sort of fits into the ecosystem of public safety.
Yeah, well, so I think one of the things that I have found to be a really important way to understand this situation is the recognition that 911, somebody calling 911, is the single most determinant of police contact that people have across the city and across the country, right? And so, you know, the ways in which police are interacting in our communities is often the result of someone calling them. But they're not necessarily the best person to respond in those instances. And so we really want to congratulate the city of Chicago for taking a more holistic approach and recognizing that the police should not be the default response to all 911 calls, but also want to encourage, you know, everyone to think about other ways in which we can respond to people's problems. We think about 911 as the sort of system by way in which we call the police, but I think we have for far too long conflated 911 with services that people need. The vast majority of calls to 911 actually have nothing to do with crime. Only about 2% of 911 calls have anything to do with violence, for example. But this default responder of the police, which unfortunately has also created this sort of acrimonious mentality in a lot of the ways in which they approach community. Many of us have heard the police use this term of being slaves to the radio. There's a lot wrong with that phrase that we need like a whole other day to unpack. But the reality is that, you know, a lot of police departments and officers see themselves as put upon by having to respond to civil disorders and, you know, disputes between neighbors and things of that nature, which they know that they're not well positioned to do. But we have not come up with other resources and plans in order to wholeheartedly serve people's needs. Because when people call 911, it's most often one of the worst moments in their lives. And not like an instance in which they're often, you know, calling about something that they're excited about and that they have 12 other people that they can call. It really is often a line of last resort. But if someone calls, it also demonstrates that they have some confidence that the public systems are there to help them. And if they don't, if we fail to show up in those moments, then we've lost the ability to serve them and their confidence and trust in the future.
Thank you. Eric, I want to bring you in, obviously. What is the role of the business community in the ecosystem of public safety?
So the business community has a very important role to play, and we believe that we have to be very intentional on playing that role as a partner. And about 2 years ago, the Civic Committee, led by Jim Crown, launched the Public Safety Task Force. This group has been really an important partner here in the city for well over 40 or 50 years. We have worked on initiatives around the O'Hare Expansion Initiative or the underfunded pension liability situation or thinking about how we support education. This was the first time that we took on the Public Safety Initiative. And we recognize that it is the number one priority of our city. We have to ensure that we have a city that where people can work and live and be safe. And so the way we have approached it is to think about it exactly how we think about running a business. What are sort of the goals that we have in place for ensuring that we can make Chicago one of the safest cities? So we began this journey first by really trying to do a lot of the analysis to understand the root causes. And I think we have to acknowledge that the crisis is due in large part to disinvestment and systemic barriers that have lasted for far too long. And so we also recognize that there are a lot of other factors that are part of the ecosystem, many of which were unmasked during the pandemic. We know, for instance, that the rate of dropout from high school is a direct correlation to the rate of violence in communities. We understand the fact that there's a concentration of the violence that is occurring. Typically, there's about 5% of the blocks around the city of Chicago that are creating 50% of the crime. We know that there is a large population within the ages of 18 to 25 that are in that at-risk population that are creating and driving a lot of the crime in the city. So we took it upon ourselves to come up with a goal of saying that we want Chicago to be one of the safest big cities, and to do that over a measurable period of time, over 10 years. We benchmarked against New York and LA, the two largest cities, and recognized that in order for us to achieve that goal, we have to see a reduction in the rate of homicide and the rate of violent crime of approximately 80% over that 10-year period, just to be on par with those cities. So we developed a 4-point plan to address that. And we are doing that by thinking about ways that we can invest in community violence intervention programs, programs that have certainly an evidence-based approach to addressing the violent crime that's occurring in the communities, and working with those that are closest to it, that are victims and that are also perpetrators, to understand what are the solutions. The other three areas that we're focused on are around creating jobs, what we can do best. Third, thinking about ways that we can promote community and economic development. As you think about the Discover Call Center in Chatham, for instance, those are the types of projects that we need to make sure that we're bringing to the south and west side of Chicago. Lastly, thinking about ways that we can support and provide resources to the Chicago Police Department to ensure effective constitutional policing and law enforcement in a way that allows us to know that we're getting at the root causes of the problems, and that we're also providing accountability, but also helping to restore trust and engagement in the community. Lastly, the way the business community is approaching is by raising funding that is critical. As it relates to community violence intervention, we made a commitment a little over a year ago to raise $100 million to support scaling up community violence intervention. 1 year into that, we have achieved that milestone of having raised the $100 million. Now, given the complexity of the issue, as we have really begun that hard work, now we're focused on the implementation, and we realize that there's still much more to be done. We work collaboratively to create a one-table approach so that we're working in partnership with the governor and the mayor, our superintendent of police, who has been a stalwart leader and the type of leadership that Chicago has been lacking for far too long. But we're also working with our community leaders and with our state's attorney's office to make sure that we have a one-table approach to bring diverse viewpoints and perspectives, because the business community does not have all of the answers. We know that in partnership with the community that we can address this issue and change the narrative so that Chicago is no longer known as one of the most violent cities, but that we're known as one of the cities that is leading the way and making a national change. Now that we've raised $100 million, we're now committed to raising another $100 million, with $75 million of that going to support the Chicago Police Department, with hiring, training, and development that will be important for them. Thinking about ways that we can invest in technology. They have antiquated systems that don't talk to each other. They have evidence sitting on shelves that can't help go towards solving crimes because they don't have the technology to do that. And they have a budget that's $2 billion 97% of that is tied towards salaries and expenses. So they don't have the wherewithal to make the investments that they need. We don't have the time to sit and wait for the government and the city to find the funding. So we're going around the system and we're finding ways to raise the funding that's needed. So $75 million will go for that. Another $25 million will go toward workforce development and job creation. So we have to be intentional and purpose-driven, and that's the role that the business community is playing.
All right. Thank you for sharing all of that. And I want to stick with that for a little bit and then come back to some of the other things in the report that we started with. But since we're on it, so that's impressive to have raised $100 million in just over a year, under a year, and then to double down on that effort and say we're going to raise another $100 million, maybe in less than a year. Who knows? So some folks are going to hear $100 million for the Chicago Police Department. Not taxpayer dollars, obviously. You all are working to fundraise those dollars. But some folks are going to have concern and say, more money for the police department in a day and age when we're having lots of conversations about how we're funding and how much money we're funding our police department with. Why do you all feel it's important that CPD gets that, you said, $75 million? And what is it that they need?
Sure.
What problem is that solving?
So, as we all know, the Chicago Police Department is actually under a consent decree. And in order to be in compliance with that consent decree, they have to adhere to certain requirements. One of those is around hiring, training, and development. In order to do that, they need the resources that they would be required to provide that sort of training and development. As you think about a lot of the violent crime that may occur, our superintendent has a vision of thinking about de-escalation, which is critical to solving a lot of the crime that takes place. That training is part of that work that's to be required. Another key aspect would be specifically as you think about workforce allocation. It's important for us to ensure that our law enforcement officials are deployed for violent crime. Not every 911 call requires a police officer to be on duty. There are times when you may need a mental health professional, a social worker. And so resource allocation is an important requirement and tool that the police department needs to have. In order for them to be able to have that sort of workforce allocation, there has to be resources available to conduct the work, the research, and to do the sort of analysis and development of a workforce allocation program that will support their efforts. When we think about things that are critical for CPD, we have to make sure that our police officers actually have the tools and the resources to solve crimes. We also have to think about the partnership between the state's attorney's office and our court system. So there has to be criminal justice reform so that we can ensure accountability. The clearance rate for the crimes that are being solved is well below where it needs to be. And that means that we need to make sure that there is collaboration between the state's attorney's office and the local law enforcement in order to solve those crimes. The last thing that is fundamentally important as we sit here in a community is thinking about ways that we rebuild community trust and engagement. Our communities do not feel comfortable reporting crimes because they are afraid of the retaliation that will take place. They are afraid, or they may not know, the local police officers that are patrolling their communities. We have to rebuild that trust. The police department needs the tools and the resources that will be important in order to foster that engagement and trust that's important. And funding is critical for that as well.
So I feel like that's a lot for, thank you. I feel like that is a lot, well, and not in a bad way, though. I feel like it is a lot for the four of you to get on as well, because it's, as we've said, it is an ecosystem of public safety. And so, Tim and Heather, I'm going to come to you next. And everyone, please welcome Pam Bosley. Thank you. I want to let you catch your breath before I come in with a question. So sit tight. I'm glad you made it. Heather, double checking my questions. Rebecca, we talk a lot about, you know, sort of, we can't police our way out of our problems. And then, you know, we have sort of, sorry, I'm going to form a question here. We talk a lot about, like, not being able to police our way out of the problem, but What is the, you know, sort of the alternative, and what changes can be made in policing that go beyond, you know, the reforms that we have to do because of the consent decree that can yield a better outcome than the outcomes that we see?
Yeah, I mean, well, I actually think that the consent decree offers an excellent opportunity to face some of these issues that the city hasn't had to previously. And if we look at some other cities that have successfully managed through consent decrees, what some of the police chiefs have shared publicly and privately about that experience, and these are chiefs who are not who were supportive of the consent decree going forward. They weren't resisting it. Sorry, that was the word. what they said is that it actually was quite helpful because there were resources that they didn't have access to that now all of a sudden, like, there had to be a different set of conversations that came to play. But the challenge is that in these pattern and practice investigations, the Department of Justice is actually quite limited in what they can look at, which may seem kind of surprising given how long some of these reports are. You can look at their finding reports and they're hundreds of pages long. But for example, if you look at the 911 system, the Department of Justice is only allowed to look at pattern and practice as it relates to violations of the ADA, of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And what we know is that there are pattern and practice issues that go way beyond just a failure to adhere to the ADA. And so it sort of opens up this opportunity to look at things. But if handcuffs were the solution to these problems, they would have been solved a long time ago, right? We have arrested enough people in this country. There are enough people who have arrest records in the United States that if they held hands, it would circle the globe over three times. We do not have a problem with having used handcuffs. We've been really good at it. And we've been really good at using it for a lot of wrong reasons. We send people away for long periods of time, often for nonviolent offenses, and then have no resources for them to come home to when they return. And it's absolutely tragic. And so we have to think about things in a much more problem-solving way. But we also have to think about it and how it's affecting different communities differently, right? And so we know that gun violence is a huge problem. We know that access to guns is a huge problem. If I can just look at my statistics, 79% of homicides in this country happen because of somebody using a gun. And over half, 53% of suicides result from people using a gun. Police are terrified of guns. They actually can be one of our greatest allies when we think about gun reform and gun restrictions around guns, because part of the reason why they're going onto scenes so hot is because they assume everyone has a gun. And they're overestimating what their own personal risks are. And when they have been wrong about their own personal risks, we've not held them accountable. So I think one of the real values of this story in Springfield is that we're seeing a police officer who had unsuccessful experiences at six different police departments, and that the department took very swift action to fire him after murdering a woman who a 911 call was made in advance of trying to seek mental health assistance. But that is not the norm, right? The norm is that names are not released, conversations are not had. And when we start to talk about this, we have to address the disparities that are involved. Homicide victims in this country, almost 54% of them are Black or brown people. Only 13.6% of the U.S. population is Black. Right? This is an unbelievable amount of disparity that just absolutely cannot be tolerated. And what we've seen in other facets of the criminal justice system is when we try to deal with issues of disparity, we end up equaling the disparity instead of making it go away. So, like, for example, you know, Colorado, one of the first states that legalized marijuana, one of the primary motivations were that drug arrests were so disparate for Black people in the state. So it was really compelling to voters to do something about this problem. Well, guess what's happened? White people are now getting arrested at far higher rates for marijuana charges in the state of Colorado. So the disparities have decreased, but the levels of arrests have not. And so, like, just thinking through what these policy strategies are to really address people's fundamental
challenges that are resulting in the systemic issues that you described so well, and having a response in an emergency crisis ecosystem that meets people where they are. Most of the time when people call 911, they tell you what they think they need and want. We don't listen to them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lauren, I want to bring you back in. You've been quiet, and then Pam, Tim, will come to you as well. What is your reaction to some of what you've heard, especially, you know, with regard to the investment that the business community wants to make, particularly, you know, I'm not sure if the word supporting CPD is right, but kind of it is, right? Because it is making sure that it is, you know, funding that they can do their jobs better than they've been doing them. Does the community feel like it needs or has the support of the business community?
I believe that the community feels that they need more support, not just from the business community, but from public administrations and also the politicians that they live amongst. But when listening to my fellow panelists, a lot of things come to mind. What we're hearing from the community is that when we hear terms like black-on-black crime, we believe that that's a fallacy. We also understand that the root cause of a lot of violence and a lot of crime is poverty. And when you live in communities, when you live in certain communities, it's not a color issue. It's a poverty issue. So that crime still exists in other communities outside of the black and brown communities. And I think we need to change the narrative and do more about changing that narrative. I have no reason to think ever that when we sit amongst our community and we listen to their experiences and their stories, we don't necessarily hear an anti-police opinion. There are numerous reasons for the violence and our crime, and our community tell us what those reasons are. There are certain communities that are affected by crime. There are certain communities that are affected by a lot of poverty. And in those situations, there's a lot of factors. It isn't that we don't have enough police. That has never been the question or the issue in our communities. We definitely have a lot of police. We need a lot more help in a lot of more sectors outside of CPD. And that isn't saying anything negative about the police at all.
I lied. Pamela, I'm coming to you last. Tim, I want you to sort of frame this up for us, if you would, just in kind of how all of these different, avenues of response, right, like different approaches to the problem, because we've heard them named in different ways, how all that sort of fits together.
Yeah, I appreciate the question, and I appreciate the other comments. In particular, Rebecca was talking about how the consent decree, you know, has limitations. There are things that the Department of Justice couldn't even measure to then therefore put into the consent decree. And I think that is a reminder that the goal isn't to just achieve, you know, compliance with the consent decree. The goal is, you know, lasting, you know, policing reform that is achieving, you know, public safety in the community. And therefore, what are the different essential elements that one needs to do that? And we've talked about some of them today, but I think one illustration for us that really, I think, changed how we viewed it was from a research project we supported at the Joyce Foundation in 2018, where we wanted to understand why people were carrying guns in certain neighborhoods in Chicago, because we were seeing all this evidence that if you had a gun, you would be less safe. You were more likely to die by suicide or homicide or otherwise if you had a gun. So we said to ourselves, well, clearly then, why would people carry guns? And the research study showed us that people carry guns because they need to feel safe, and they feel like that provides safety. And they don't feel safe because, as Eric was talking about, there was a lack of trust and accountability in law enforcement. And as Lauren was talking about, there has not been enough economic opportunity for people. And so, therefore, they find themselves in community where they may not be feeling safe. And so, to your question of framing this all up and to think about how these all work together, in our view, they're all interconnected. Right? You need to worry about what the supply or the flow of illegal guns. You need to ensure that policing is fair and constitutional. You need to make sure that 911 is responsive to what communities are asking for, and that, as you were talking about, Lauren, what communities need in terms of their investment. So that's how we view it at the Joyce Foundation. And I guess one final thing I'll say, you know, Eric, what you were describing has been such an impressive investment in such a short amount of time. And so we are very grateful to the business community for doing that. I also want to acknowledge that some of our other partners are here. I see Esther Franco-Payne, who is the executive director of the Partnership for Safe and Peaceful Communities, and Julie Weiland, some of the other philanthropy partners. And you had mentioned that one table approach. We couldn't agree more in terms of what's necessary. And I think the more that we can adopt that approach to this entire issue of public safety, that includes even some of the root causes that you were talking about, Lauren, I think the better that will be.
Thank you. Quick reminder, you can submit your questions to Amanda over here on a blue piece of paper, and I'll get to them shortly. So we're... I'll get to them when I get to them, people. Thank you. So, I'm kidding. Pam Bosley, I'm glad you made it.
Thank you.
If you would you mind sharing with the audience sort of your story and what brings you to this work?
Yes. And good evening, everybody. Sorry I was late. But what brings me to this work is, unfortunately, my son, Terrell Bosley, at the age of 18, was shot on the grounds of a church, a place that should have been safe. That first year after Terrell's life was taken, I tried to take my life twice. And, you know, the trauma and everything was difficult for me and my family. We did everything right, we thought, to, you know, raise our son, and he's not here. We drove Terrell to and from the school. He was a gospel bass player. He was in college. He was doing the right things. And his life was taken on the grounds of a church. And actually... the reason why, the part that I'm going to bring into the conversation today is the unsolved cases, because the day when Terrell's life was taken, the police department, the detectives, they was supposed to have been solving this case, but for 2 weeks, they went and tried to find out his character before they started digging into his case. So 18 years later, Terrell's case remains unsolved. And that's not just my story. That's so many stories in this room, because I see Liz Ramirez. I think her son, the case is solved, but she worked with parents whose case is not solved. Diana, I see Delphine. So it's so many cases unsolved. And the group that I'm over now is called a group called Purpose Over Pain. We started in 2007. Our goal is to support other parents like ourselves, try to get our cases solved. We, the voices in the community, on behalf of our children. We canvass the community with flyers just like this. Walking the community, trying to get our cases solved, and we go out sometime with detectives when they go with us. We get information. For Terrell's case, actually, I got information. I found out that the person shot and killed my son made a joke. He played like Terrell was in some gang, and then they shot and killed him. I told that to the detectives. 18 years, still, my case remains unsolved. And as you watch the news every single day, we see when it's black and brown families, children shot and killed, we always hear the end that no one's in custody. It'd be like a 7-year-old was shot, a 5-year-old was shot, no one's in custody. And that's why Purpose Over Pain, we go out as parents, we try to solve our own cases because we loved our children and we're their voice. And there's so much trauma that goes along with that pain, us not having justice. We don't have no justice. We wake up, we can't sleep at night. We have a lot of trauma going on within our life because we're searching for justice. We're trying to find out who shot and killed our child. So that's why we offer the $5,000 reward, and we connect with other parents like ourselves. And I want to bring up a point that I don't know if you all saw the Live Free report that they put out in July dealing with unsolved cases. They talked about that in Chicago, only 17% of the cases were solved. In Chicago. And so that if you do the math, that means 83% of the cases remain unsolved. So the parents I talk to every single day, majority of the cases are not solved. So that's why I'm passionate about trying to come up with ways to get these cases solved. And then compared to other states, I kind of looked it up. I think it's Chicago. I'm not sure if it's Chicago and Baltimore. It's Chicago and one more state that had the most unsolved cases. And I was looking at Joyce Foundation's report, and actually you all just had that meeting like a month ago, and we had ATF there. And ATF was going into details of ways that they can solve these cases. They had like the E-Trace. The E-Trace is a system that the police department can use as an internet system that they can discuss, find out what they can look and see. different gun crime scenes, and they could talk about it and find different, you know, the guns, because every gun have a story, every bullet have a story, every shell casing have a story. So all these stories can be put into this system, so they can find out. Like when Terrell was killed, he was killed with a 45 caliber. He had a bullet in him, and that when I was studying that looking at Joyce Foundation's report, it was saying that each gun that shoot out a bullet, you can't get a duplicate one. All of them are different. Every gun that shoot a bullet is different. So the bullet that was in Terrell, the 45 caliber bullet that was in him, they would have pulled that bullet out. I want to know how many more people got shot with that same gun. A gun is your fingerprint, so you should be able to take that same gun, trace that gun back to the person, and get our cases solved. So that's why I was studying that report, because I'm not an ATF expert, but I'm trying to be, because I will still want my son's case solved. And I've been researching, trying to figure out ways to get his case solved. So we need to invest in the ATF, that resource that they have. They have four different methods to help solve cases, and the police department's not using them. It's only like 33% of the police departments that's using it. We need more and more people to use that, because we need to get these cases solved. So if you get the cases solved, you can get the shooters off the street, and then you can save lives. How many people in here lost somebody to violence? That's the room right there. So we all in this system together. We're trying to figure out how to make it stop. And the only way it can stop is we have to solve these cases. And for me, it's been 18 years, but I believe, God, that my case is going to get solved. And I look at my group, it's called Purpose Over Pain, and I believe God has me here for his purpose over my daily pain. So that's my...
Thank you, Pam, and for many reasons, we're glad you're here. I think we've got time to pivot to Q&A, and thanks to all of you who've submitted your questions, because I think there are several that are good and that we should probably try and get to them. Amanda's going to give me one more. Stand by. Amanda's getting her steps in. You're doing great.
Two more.
Just kidding. Two more.
We'll collect them all if you have them, and make sure the panelists have a chance to see it if you don't get a chance to.
Yeah, and I will try. Some of them are on similar topics, so I'm going to try and diversify. So I apologize in advance if I don't get to all of your questions. This one comes from someone I know, Mary Stoner Saunders. Thank you. Several days ago, three outreach peacekeeper workers were shot. One lost his life. How do we ensure the ecosystem we are building includes investing in these workers' safety, resilience, and recognition of their vital service? I believe it's an issue of both effectiveness and equity. I'm going to add on to that, because I remember in the Motive podcast that WBEZ did, I think a couple of years ago, they focused on violence interventionists and just sort of like the struggles. Like, you know, they're not getting paid very much. They've got their own lives. They are on call pretty much 24/7 to do the jobs that they do. And then we expect, and they're traumatic as well. And then we ask them to keep going. Very difficult jobs. I probably don't have to tell the folks in this room that. So I'm just going to throw that out to whichever of you would like to jump on that one.
I think other people probably have different and maybe better responses, but one thing that I would like to share is that, you know, a first responder designation is something that's established by the Bureau of Labor Statistics at the federal level. And right now, it's a very exclusive term that is only applicable for fire, police, and EMT, EMS personnel. But the whole idea around trying to redefine the first response ecosystem is that a first responder is the person who's first on scene, who is first responding to the situation. There's actually a bill that's been introduced into Congress to try to redefine 911 professionals as first responders, who today the Bureau of Labor Statistics defines as secretaries or administrative assistants.
Wow.
And this sounds like really technocratic, but why it matters is that first responders, when you're classified in that way, you have access to a whole variety of benefits,
disability benefits, death benefits in the event that you're killed, which is an unfortunate reality, but something that everybody who's a first responder to risks and should make sure that their family is taken care of in the same sort of ways. It also appreciates the fact that these are really stressful jobs, and so it caps retirement at a lower level. Because if you look at the statistics of wellness and occupational, psychiatrists have found that actually 911 professionals have double and triple the rates of suicide ideation, depression, anxiety, and all of these other measures than even police and firefighters that are, not seen in that way. And we assume that other kinds of alternative responders, including CBI workers, are also subjected to just as, if not higher, levels of occupational stress and threats. And that's something that absolutely needs to be and can be addressed. But it is not cost neutral, right? Letting people retire earlier, making sure that they have good access to benefits costs money. But it is absolutely important, and it also supports the workforce. It supports communities. It means that people can stay in their jobs a longer time, so we have lower attrition rates and vacancy rates, and it means that people can develop richer relationships with communities.
If I can add one thing to summarize, is that what I'm hearing you say is that the workers that were at issue in your question, that they need to be viewed as essential workers now, right? They are part of the essential workforce for this public safety ecosystem we're talking about. But they haven't been treated that way to date. And I think people are starting to come to understand the ramifications of not doing that. There's some research now being done out of Northwestern University, Andy Papakristos and his team at Corners, and they're understanding how they have been. There's a lack of wages. There's a lack of training. There's a lack of supports, whether it be health insurance or otherwise. You compound that with the trauma that they experience every day because of the places that their work, their employment brings them to. And so I think that is one of the things that needs to change in terms of how we think about investments. And I know that is something that the one table approach, Eric, that you've been supporting, is that it is an investment in the CVI workforce, because that is really going to be essential to keep this as a sustainable entity moving forward.
And it's essential that we not create a caste system within our first response system.
Warren?
I think you used the term violence interrupted.
Or interventionist.
For us, and a lot of our work that we found is some of our first violence interrupters were our neighbors. Mr. Jones from down the street, Mrs. Jones from up the street. They need support. A lot of these people do the work for free. And I don't think it's a question of money itself. The business owners themselves need to offer support. The community themselves need to offer support. We're big on accountability, and I think it starts there also. But we have to offer the infrastructure for these programs and these people to function. It isn't just about money all the time.
Several people wrote a similar question, and so I'm going to try and combine this as best I can from several of you. And I'm going to read one of them. Hey, Todd. Given how ineffective police have been at preventing crime and solving crime, why hasn't the business community committed their funds and support to community orgs that have proven to be more effective at both? And similarly, some have asked, why not give that money directly to underinvested communities or organizations that are dedicated to getting in front of violence early in youth without so much reporting red tape?
Sure. So I want to be very clear. What we have tried to do as a business community is to approach it with a comprehensive approach. And so what I suggested was that there were four parts of the strategy. One was to invest in community violence intervention organizations, CVI, on the programmatic side. The other is to create jobs. Third is economic development. And the fourth is related to providing additional funding for Chicago Police Department. The complexity of the issue, as we all know, is that those four areas alone will not solve the problem. We are trying to focus on it from the perspective of understanding what the acute issues are, but we also have to work harder to understand the underlying part of it. We're all saying the same thing. We recognize that poverty is a root cause of the issues, so we have committed to focusing on economic development. We recognize that systemic racism, public policy issues have led to the Tale of Two Cities. We are trying to approach it from the standpoint of saying, what can we do to address the urgent crisis that we have? But fundamentally, we also have to focus on the organizations that are supporting prevention. Prevention is a huge part of the solution. Not only do we have violent crime being conducted from folks that are in the age bracket of 18 to 25, but we now have a rash of young kids, 8, 9, 10 years old, that are involved in carjacking, that are involved in snatch and grab, that are involved in dropping out of school and getting very much so involved in violent crime. And if we don't cut off that pipeline of those young kids that are then growing up to join gangs, then we know that we'll never get at the heart of the problem. So I understand the question of someone saying, well, why are we providing funding to the Chicago Police Department? What we're saying is that there is a comprehensive approach that we're trying to take to target all of the resources that are required to help us address the crisis. There's no one answer. And I want to be very clear as well, when we say that the business community is raising the funding for the $100 million that we raised to help scale up community violence intervention, that largely came from foundations. The Crown Family Foundation, the Pritzker Family Foundation, we had the Lucas Walton Foundation, and then we had a number of companies that stepped up. BMO, Hyatt Corporation, McDonald's, Aon, ITW, and many others. As we think about the additional $75 million that I mentioned for policing, we are targeting wealthy individuals that we believe will support the policing work, because many companies are not willing, from a reputational risk perspective, to provide funding directly to CBD, just like they're not willing to provide funding directly to CPS. And so we are targeting different pools of funding in order to provide the needed resources. We also recognize that the state and the city play a very important role in terms of providing some of the needed funding that comes from tax dollars. And the governor did include an additional $100 million in the most recent budget that will go towards scaling up CVI. So we're trying to make sure that we can bring together the tools and the resources that are needed in a variety of different areas.
Why y'all can't put jobs in there, though?
I said jobs.
People with backgrounds, though, because it's hard for them to get jobs.
We're going to pivot to table talk in just a second, but there was one question from an audience member. In addition to raising money, could the business community shift some of their practices, maybe opening up job opportunities for people who are system impacted, or do what Discover did, where establish a piece of their business in the community the way the Discover, the call center is?
So again, I thought I explained that was an important effort that we wanted to make sure that we undertake in terms of providing job opportunities. The job opportunities that we were focused on will first be to provide roughly 20,000 jobs over 5 years, 4,000 a year, that would be specifically tied to the CVI program. It's important that we make sure that as those organizations like Ready and Chicago Cred are providing the community violence intervention programs, that they're giving not only these individuals a second chance, but that they're providing a job. You can't have a second chance if you don't have a job. You can't have a job if you don't have job training. You can't provide that programming unless those organizations have the funding. Those are the organizations that are in the community that understand the urgent needs that are present in those communities. The business community does not have all the answers. We believe that the community does. We want to invest in those communities and empower those communities to provide the transformational change that we believe is very important.
And it's a deep-rooted problem, right? Like the business community alone. I think that's why we're having this conversation with the five panelists that we have, is that the business community alone is not going to solve our problems.
I was just going to say the same exact thing, right? You know, the business community, I think, is one part of the pillars that are necessary to bring those things about. You know, what the public sector does, with respect to city, state, and the national government and the investment that they're making, philanthropy and the sort. I think this is all a shared responsibility.
And to Lauren's point, like the community members themselves taking it on.
What we found is the community has the answers. They are the direct ones, the direct people being affected by the problems and the issues, so why wouldn't they have the answers? They might not have the resources, they might not have the funding, but they have the answers. We just have to listen.
So first, please help me thank our panelists one more time. And so I think, you know, this is the part where we sort of go into our group discussions. I appreciate that some of our groups are shaped differently and not in circular tables, but I trust that you all will be able to work it out. I think you will have facilitators who will take notes, and then we'll get back together in some minutes, in about 20 minutes, and we'll ask you all what you came up with. Thank you. Hi, everybody. So I'm going to hand it over. Yep, I'm going to hand it over. And then we're going to talk about what you guys came up with, right?
So I think everyone at my table is brilliant, and I want to keep in touch with everybody. The key takeaways from our conversation were that we can solve gun violence by relationships and resources. We need to engage people directly where they're at, across communities, having relationships with parents, schools, and the people on the corner who are selling the drugs and causing crime. We need resources, real jobs that pay good money to be able to have access to quality goods and services in our neighborhoods. And we can't talk at people. We have to listen. We have to make sure the people who are directly impacted are in the room. And we have to keep coming back to the conversation because all of us have expertise. All of us have something to say. And in order to address the root causes, we have to know what people really need. Is there anything in my group that I missed? Awesome.
One thing that I want to point out that we talked about that was really, really important to me was we talked about the second prompt, which was how can we address the root causes of gun violence and improve outcomes for marginalized communities. And one thing that I feel like is really important to me is we need to implement social emotional learning in CPS schools, because we need to end this cycle of hatred and retaliation and revenge. These young boys, these young brown and black boys and girls don't know how to handle their emotions because they were never taught. Like, a lot of our parents weren't here. I didn't have my parents. I learned it in school. I didn't learn how to process my emotions in my house, in my home, in my neighborhood, in my community. So I feel like if we invest in that, that's where we can start. That's a root cause.
All right. So we talked about the necessary elements of public safety ecosystem, and we talked about data equity, getting that feedback from the community, access to safe housing, because when people experience trauma, most of the time they're going back to that same place that the perpetrators know where they live. So that's a problem. We also talked about like public health access being part of that ecosystem. And then, of course, me being reparations-based, I made sure that we understood that most of that is covered under reparations. So the other thing that we talked about was the fact that commercial properties, we learned today that most of the people just sit on them in the destitute areas. And so we don't have those businesses, and it seems like they get some sort of tax credits from just sitting on these properties. So, and then most of the time we are finding also that you can't find out who owns these properties to even address that problem. So the areas look like, you know, deserts or war zones because they're disinfested. The other thing that we talked about on our last page, if I can get there, is, and you got to bear with me because I was thrown into this one. We talked about the fact that, like, CPD gets to buy their own guns, and that was disturbing for us to kind of even hear and even trying to understand, because, one, we talked about the city not even getting breaks, right? We're talking about this exacerbated, like, budget. And then, but you get to go buy these guns, the police, from who? Creditable resources? Where are you getting your guns from? So, not just that, you know, we were talking about just a lot of different things in gun violence in general, but stemming from the root problems of the poverty. So just want to thank my team for being great. And if I forgot something else that we talked about, then they'll let me know.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Ashley Miller. We spoke about a lot of things, so I'm just going to dive directly into it. We talked about having a rapid response system, but we also talked about revitalizing block clubs and getting block clubs trained on social-emotional learning, restorative justice, as well as taking that social-emotional learning inside of school systems so that it can go from the classroom back to the block and back from the block to the classroom. We talked about more youth programs and organization. We talked about community policing. So with the revitalization of block clubs, we're looking at community policing. We're doing restorative justice circles directly on the block. I think every community member should have somebody that's a chair that should be trained, and then that should be transcended. We talked about entrepreneurial opportunities for our young people. And when we talk about that, we talk about things as prolific as grant writing, right? A lot of our young people want to be entrepreneurs. Right. So how better to fund themselves than to write their own grants, to understand money that's being pulled down from corporations, big businesses and everything. We also talked about the business community, and we talked about how it could not be just a narrow pathway to CVI worker. That is a very, very narrow thing. We have people who want to be scientists, astronauts. We have ex-felons that have returned back to society and have reclaimed their lives, and they are stagnant because they don't have access to equitable jobs and trainings that will help them create a new generation. We also talked about just community having control over safety, community accountability. And also pairing social workers with police, as well as with organizations as well, mental health clinicians. So I believe Bill Chicago has a model that they sent out. They have someone that works with, they have a social worker, they have an outreach specialist, and they go out into community to meet with community members that have been harmed by violence, and they bring resources straight to their door. So I think that we can have an intentional response like that when violence happens in our community, that we'll be, you know, ahead of the curve. Thank you.
Tim Russell, a lot of things that we talked about has actually been mentioned, but a couple of things that we do want to highlight is that there's a lot of committees, whether they're civic committees, whether they're CPD committees, but one of the things is that the committees generally do not have community residents on those committees, because the people who have been impacted are the ones who have solutions, answers. We talked a lot about block clubs, about safe spaces, public libraries, schools, that schools, public libraries rent out spaces to preachers on a Sunday, but then will not at times volunteer or donate spaces for community organizations to come together and to meet. We also talked about holding aldermen and elected officials accountable, specifically around the fact that all aldermen have have enforcing community night. My handwriting is chicken scratch. Should have been a doctor, so sorry. But you know, have these nights in which communities come together, but oftentimes they're not publicized. Oftentimes people don't know about it. So figuring out what's the strategy, talking with community members to find out what's the best way to communicate to them. We also talked about just gun safety in general. Often, and this actually, we never got off our first page, but this was a part of our in-depth conversation around gun safety. Our notion at times is quickly take guns away, remove guns, but not, which we're not saying shouldn't be done. But we're also saying that no one really talks about gun safety. You know, and so, and meaning with that, you know, when I was a kid, I'm sure some of you who are my age and maybe slightly older, we had, you know, the, I just lost the train of thought. You know, you were like scared straight. Not to say that that worked, but, or like you had the test or the film about pregnancy or the diseases that you get, and it scared you. And so oftentimes having those conversations about guns, having to show, like, what do you actually get if you commit a crime? What happens to a person's body, to yourself, around trauma and things of that nature? How does that impact you? And so those are some of the things we talked about with that. And am I missing anything else? Oh, healthcare, finally. Healthcare organizations are never brought to the table for those conversations. And every community has whether it's a free clinic, a health care, a hospital, or something that's there that are seeing those that are seeing victims and families first impacted by trauma, and they're never brought to the table. So figuring out how do we bring them to the table as well.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jessica Watkins. I'm with the Illinois Black Advocacy Initiative, and this is my lovely table. A lot of what we said is also being covered, so I'll just kind of talk quick. The first prompt, we said jobs and also emphasis on who gets those jobs, including those with non-traditional training, system-impacted people, people who live in the community, and emphasis on workforce readiness. We also talked about the need for wraparound services, including nutrition, food, transportation. We need youth programming, community orgs that have the resources and also have the resources to get the funding necessary, so to you all's point about grant writing. And we also talked about community development, emphasis on business, transportation, and connection between stakeholders. And for our next question, the nice, clear answer is poverty and resources to help alleviate that.
Hi, my name's Tara. I'm from France. I'm honored to be with you today. I'm a community organizer back there. And I was with this great team with Jessica, Eve, Annette, Trayvon, Tom, Todd, Diana. Thank you. We talked about how, first of all, families who, to your point, Pam, are not finding the support they need in getting crime solved. They need stable, community dedicated and trained detectives to work with families. We talked about how on the one side there's police burnout, on the other there's breakdown, there isn't what's necessary at home for families, for kids to go through life. We talked about also how there were bills that could have been presented, like the Victims' Rights Act and the Homicide Data Act, that were supposed to be presented and were not. And we also had a conversation about some crimes get solved. How come these crimes don't get solved? And how do we hold police accountable for these crimes? And then we talked about basically, this is a table of a lot of organizers, so it's not that there aren't resources, it's that how do you connect these resources? There's not enough connectedness. And so the key takeaway is, if everybody agrees that community knows best in terms of solutions, how come communities aren't making decisions about where the money goes? So that's our key takeaway. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Damien and I represent Breakthrough Urban Ministries and Chicago Boys and Girls Club of Chicago. We've echoed many of the same things that each group has said. Three things that I think I would like to highlight. Coalition building is something that we have piloted over at East Garfield Park at our King Club. So obviously our works are adjacent to each other from both of our organizations, and we know what we do good and we know what they do well, and so we marry that together. We replicated this at our King Club, our Jordan Club, and we are launching in our Bright Club in the Trumbull Park neighborhood. But three essences that we found is coalition building, so sharing those resources, especially as a bigger nonprofit, linking up with your smaller nonprofits that are doing the work, right? Professionalizing the field. That's something that I think has been echoed a couple different ways throughout this conversation tonight. And so that's something that we are also doing. And then obviously incorporating the youth voice. And so whatever we are doing, we are ensuring that the youth are the front focus of that. And sometimes we have to bridge those kids that are not coming to our service areas, wherever they are. And those are going to be where our CVIs, our interrupters are. And I think when we have those three kind of recipes all put together, we can definitely make some change in our neighborhoods. But I'm very encouraged by all of you all tonight as well.
Hi, everybody. I'm Quentin Williams. I have the distinct pleasure of working with Mr. Tim Daly and Sabrina and Casey at the Joyce Foundation in our gun violence prevention and justice reform program. My group over there, they are all teachers and stuff from a school, so it was kind of good, a good perspective. And what we talked about first was to how each neighborhood in Chicago's violence problem is different. And from the perspective of the table, felt like that local nature of gun violence needed to be addressed in that way. And I talked about we have 77 community areas. I mean, and that's a lot of area to cover. But the point was is that because they're from the South Side, and they said that Ogdale Gardens is different than Roseland, even though they're approximate. Yeah, okay. All right. Make me start calling the West Side people. And similar to this neighborhood, North Lawndale is right next to Little Village. Two very different violence problems, right? So I think that point was well taken. And because of that, we talked about it not being a cookie cutter solution, which is part of the point of the panel. It's going to take a number of different approaches and being creative. School perspective, and I thought that was really good, was talking about trauma, and particularly trauma in black boys in particular. But then we talked even further about trauma and talked about, well, how, you know, and because even in this, right, like we're not talking about it that much, right? Because look, jobs, that's fine, that's great, but everybody who's worked in the CVI world and who has walked and done life with a participant knows that when they get a job, then as soon as something happened at that job, they're triggered and they're flipping tables over at the job, right? But what is that, though? Is it something wrong with him? No, he saw his friend get his head blew off in front of him and his nervous system is not regulated, right? So we need to be talking about, like, healing, honestly. And so... We need more people to facilitate that healing, and healing is not linear. It doesn't happen because of a program. It's a long, ongoing journey, and it's hard, but if we be focused on it and stay committed to it, I think we could do it. But healing has to be at the center of this. That's it.
My name is Ebony Only. I have the distinct pleasure of providing support to a phenomenal organization that's here today, Black Roots Alliance. I provide HR support for them, and I'm happy to be a part of this table here. Community engagement, for question one, community engagement, not as a checkbox. Evidence-based violence prevention programs, economic opportunity and development, education, mental health and trauma support, community policing, gun policy enforcement, restorative justice programs, environmental design for safety was one thing that I did not hear from everyone else, collaboration between agencies, funding for grassroots organizations, and our funders actually hiring people with lived experiences to help to determine how we fund all of these great ideas we're coming up with today. For prompt two, how can we address the root cause of gun violence and improve outcomes for marginalized communities? Certainly economic empowerment. And economic empowerment does not look like folks showing up in our community and handing us something. It looks like empowering us with the resources that we currently have and making sure that there are no blockages to available resources for us. Education reform, healthcare access, youth development, community building, addressing systemic racism, family support, gun violence reform, gun policy reform, I'm sorry, and poverty reduction. And one of the illustrations that was given that I think certainly brought all of this home for us was a lack of prompt response from law enforcement. Who do we call? Where one of our participants, and I want to thank, I had with me Delisa, Jada, and Katina, one of the illustrations that was given was that one of our participants called police when there seemed to be a verbal altercation taking place outside of their window. They called a second time when that altercation seemed to have more people come to be involved in it. They called a third time when it seemed to escalate again. They called a fourth time, and the police still weren't there. By the time they called the fifth time, someone showed up with a ski mask on and shot the person to death. So after five calls, the police finally showed up, but guess what? It was too late. So I want to thank these wonderful women, Lisa, Jada, and Katina, for our table nine.
All right, everyone. everyone. Well, thank you so much for coming. There's a lot of food from Be Love Cafe, so please stock up on your way out and visit them down the street. Yeah, take some sandwiches to go. Thank you, everyone. We appreciate your support.